I stumbled into having to confront my past and recognizing the connection between the trauma, the anger, the hurt that I was carrying around, and how that affected the way that I pursued my relationships, how I treated myself, what I felt was possible for me.
Hey, this is Chad Namiro.
And I'm Kelly Namiro. Welcome to the Balancing Chaos podcast.
A lifestyle podcast where we will interview guests about wellness, business, and just about everything in between.
Our goal is to help you develop a lifestyle that promotes health, wholeness, and success. Through our conversations, we hope to inspire you to live a beautiful, full, and joyful life as you navigate balancing the chaos.
We hope you enjoy. All right. Natalie Liu is a writer, speaker, podcaster, artist, and founder of one of the longest-running self-help blogs in the world, Baggage Reclaim, and the Baggage Reclaim Sessions podcast. She is British-born and Ireland-raised. She has now written a beautiful book, which I have in my hand, called The Joy of Saying No, where she helps people understand how their emotional baggage is interfering with their ability to live their happiest life and be authentic. Her advice has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, NPR, USA Today, the BBC, among many others. She lives in South London with her husband. She has two daughters and a cockapoo. Welcome to the show. We're really glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. We, as I said before we started recording, we went deep into the archives of your podcast. You've been doing this for a while, like a good amount of time and
How
consistently.
Long have you been doing this?
Coming up to 8 years. Okay. I took the best part of a year's break. It's sort of in the middle of it, but yeah, about coming up to 8 years.
So tell us a little bit about how you got started in the actual podcasting space, because now everyone wants to have a podcast. How did you get started in that? And what has that experience been like for you?
So to reverse back slightly, I've had the blog, you know, the website Baggage Reclaim since September 2005. So that's like 17 and a half years.
Wow. Yeah.
And the year before I started my podcast, so I guess it was like 2014, my husband comes home from work one day and he's like, I really think you should get into podcasts. And I said, what? And he's like, yeah, I was talking about it with this guy at work and I think this would be like a really good fit. And I said, And so I remember sort of looking, I wasn't really listening to, I don't think I was listening to any podcasts at that point, but it sort of niggled. He has a way of kind of saying things that you kind of go, I better pay attention to that. And so over a few months, I started toying with the idea, but because I am a recovering people pleaser and perfectionist, I kind of overcomplicated it. So I was worried about the sound and the tech and how many I started the podcast with like 5 segments in it.
Wow.
I look back and I was like, how on earth was I doing a podcast each week with 5 different segments? About a year after he had said that, I actually went and spoke to a friend of mine's husband who is like a touring singer. And he was like, hey, borrow my recorder, showed me how to do it. Boom, podcast was up. And it just took making that first one. What was interesting, though, as I said about those 5 segments, was that I made 80 episodes like that.
Yeah.
It was 79, 80. And then my dad died. And so I was taking time out and I just did not have the energy to do 5 segments. And so what happened was it was just a intuitive, natural thing where I would jump on and record and it was one thing. And it was like just one topic. And then I was like, oh, just kind of like it like this.
Yeah.
So I stumbled into that and it's rolled on ever since.
Where do you think your ethos of helping people and tackling these specific issues came from, if I might ask?
When I started writing Baggage Reclaim, the month before that, I had this bit of an awakening where I realized that I had seemed to have a penchant for emotionally unavailable men. And I had thought that I was like Miss Monogamy. I love relationships because that's kind of all I seemed to be chasing after. But I realized that I had issues and actually that I really didn't like myself. And because I was dealing with an immune system disease at the time, and you know, I started getting help about that, I stumbled into having to confront my past and recognizing the connection between the trauma, the anger, the hurt that I was carrying around, and how that affected the way that I pursued my relationships, how I treated myself, what I felt was possible for me. And at the time I had this personal blog. So I've been blogging for like almost 19 years. And I had this personal blog. It was called Tired of Men and Other Things That Drive a 20-something Around the Twist. And I started it because I was moaning about like getting the tube and a way to work and crazy people I was working with, but also my love life. And it wasn't just that I was tired of men. I was tired of myself because I was like complaining, why can't I meet a nice guy? And yet I was never interested in a nice guy. And when I had this awakening that summer, I remember writing on my then personal blog that, you know, I had realized that I had this pattern of being involved with emotionally unavailable people, that I hated myself and all this stuff. And I thought I was a weirdo. So you can imagine my surprise when I get a whole load of comments and emails from people saying, you're talking about me.
Yeah, like, this really resonates.
Like, you are me. And I was there, well, this is unexpected. And that kind of prompted me to start writing, you know, talking out loud about what I was going through, because I had to confront the anger about my parents breaking up, about how my father's absence in my life, my father, my stepfather on my mom's chaotic relationship, you know, the crumbs that I had settled for in my, and talking out loud about that, it was like, it kind of flowed out of me. I know it sounds a bit odd, but I would go on and it's like, I'm sharing my journey and this is what I'm recognizing about myself. And bearing in mind, this is 2005. So, you know, we're not where we are now, but hell of a lot of information out there. Like it's not like I had never looked for info before, but it was always 50 ways to please your man. Like that was kind of the solution to everything.
Put like Cosmo magazine. Lingerie.
Yeah. Put on some sexy lingerie, cook him a nice meal, light a candle, you know, pull out the sexual positions. How is that going to solve my self-esteem problem or the anger that I'm carrying around about my parents? Or how is that even going to fix my toxic relationship?
Yeah.
So it was that I noticed these patterns. And it's funny because I was always the person that people came to and asked for advice. Mm-hmm. Even when I was like a teenager, plus I was a very nosy child, so I was very observing everybody's relationships. I always knew which adults were cheating, who was up to no good,
right?
And so when I started Baggage Reclaim, it was with really the mission was, if I could help one person avoid what I had been through, or I could help them get out of that, then I'd felt like I was giving back in some way, because the internet had been actually really loving and supportive of me in my journey. And I was like, I'm just going to talk out loud on this stuff and hopefully somebody else can figure out their own life from this. And fast forward, here I am.
Yeah. Like
17 and a half years later. Yeah.
I love like the making your mess your message thing. I think some of the best careers come out of that. That's definitely how I came to do the stuff I do now. And so I think that's it. It really sparks a passion when it's something that you've been through. So I think that that's fantastic. And I do really want to get into a lot of the people pleasing and perfectionism stuff, because again, something I've been through, something a lot of the women that I work with are going through. But one of the things that you said, you know, throughout this journey of yours that really stood out to me is this idea around childhood traumas kind of leading us into the things that we choose in our adult life. And so do you think that for yourself and for other people out there who are like consistently choosing the wrong partner or someone who is not, you know, going to give them the love that they feel like they actually deserve, is that typically something like a childhood trauma, like, you know, an absent father or something like that? Like, do you see that connection?
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing is, over the years, I've heard from many thousands of people who struggle to forge healthy, intimate, loving, romantic relationships, or in fact, sometimes across the board, like familial friendships at work, so forth. And there is an assumption that it's because you're a child of divorce, or, you know, single parent, or your parents were beating the bejesus out of you, or whatever it was. That is certainly going to impact. But what's been interesting is that trauma varies from person to person. Mm-hmm. And so there are some things that we go, okay, that's definitely a trauma, but we all have different ideas of what impacts us, of what has caused us deep hurt, a sense of rejection, a sense of, you know, not belonging. And there are people who are wrestling with their relationships, and they be like, yeah, but I don't get it. Like, both my parents are at home. But if you have had experiences in childhood and then gone on into adulthood and had more of those, that have essentially given you this idea that there is something not quite right about you, that you are unworthy, that you need to avoid conflict, avoid criticism, avoid intimacy, that you need to try harder than others, whatever it is, whatever messages that you've taken away that impact on the way that you see yourself, the way that you treat yourself, is going to affect the way you forge relationships. And of course, if you've got that trauma, and it's amazing how many people are here and they're like, oh, I never had any trauma in my childhood.
Yeah.
And then they start talking about it and you go, you did.
Yeah.
Because they want it to be like this tragedy, you know, this terrible thing.
Right.
But it can, I mean, the amount of people I've heard from that their trauma is what they went through at school. And that has impacted their trust levels.
Yeah.
And how they kind of keep a distance from people. So it doesn't just go into their friendships. They struggle with their romantic relationships as well, because they're always expecting that they're going to get dumped, even if this incident dates back to like when they were five.
Right. That's extremely helpful. I actually like was almost kind of like not triggered, but in that moment. So for us, just like to share a little bit about our personal, you know, relationship, we dated when we were in college. Mm-hmm. And I also was going through an eating disorder when I was in college. Right. So like exactly like the top of the ways that you can feel like unworthiness. It's like, I'm trying to like change my body to, you know, make it perfect for other people. And I think that a lot of the stuff that I did back when we dated the first time was like people pleasing him, kind of to stay in the relationship and to like make him happy or to seem like a cool girl, like, oh, I'm cool girl. Like, I'll do whatever you want to do. And then we got back together and I may now seem more high maintenance because I worked on myself. Yeah. Like through that time, I'm like, I know what I want. I know who I am. And like, I'm not scared to like ask for it or be vulnerable. And I think that's helped our relationship so much. But talk to us a little bit about that, like people pleasing in relationships. We kind of touched on the trauma and like how that attracts people, but like, then you get into a relationship and you're like, okay, here I am. And I've been people pleasing for, you know, a year now, but now I want to speak up for myself. And I kind of can't, like, I don't want to, I'm scared to show my true self.
Yeah. I mean, when we think about what people pleasing is, which is where we essentially deprioritize our needs, expectations, desires, feelings, and opinions to put others ahead of ours.
Yeah.
And that's to gain attention, affection, approval, love, and validation. And or to avoid conflict, criticism, additional stress, disappointment, loss, you know, rejection, or what we actually might term as abandonment. Now, a lot of people have internalized rather complicated messages about, for instance, romantic relationships, what it takes to be a loving partner, what it takes for a relationship to work. And so what can happen is that because somebody is already inclined to people please anyway, or their hotspot of people pleasing is their romantic relationships, because often with the romantic relationships, people end up inadvertently, but also sometimes consciously, either choosing partners that reflect you know, they're quite similar to, for instance, one or both parents or somebody key from their childhood, and or they end up consciously or inadvertently repeating habits that they learned, you know, observed in their parents or actually even saw on TV or films or books or whatever it might be. And so then what can happen is this part, you know, we get into this relationship. And when you think about how we're pitched about dating, a lot of people sell themselves on trying to be like the best girlfriend, the best boyfriend, the best partner ever, right?
Yeah.
And so they're just giving it their A game initially. And it's like trying to present as like the perfect partner. Yeah. And
very agreeable.
Everything. Yeah. Yeah, very agreeable. What do you like? I like what you like.
Yeah, totally.
He goes, what do you want to do? I want to do what you want to do. And when they're on the date and the person turns around and they're like, yeah, and my ex, they used to do this and this. The people pleaser in their minds going, mental note, must make sure I never, ever do that in our relationship. So if they hear, for instance, their date or now partner saying, yeah, you know, my previous relationship, I hate when, you know, we would argue, or I hated when they would question me about whatever. It's like, okay, note to self, don't apply any pressure.
Conflict make sure avoidant.
Yeah, you know, make sure I do that. And so many people also see it as a badge of honor to never have conflict in a relationship. So they are super agreeable, super accommodating.
She does.
I love the pointed. But what has happened is a lot of people have observed what's gone on in their own environments growing up. And so they're either like, right, we're going to go to town and we are going to fight. And then others are like, oh my God, there was so much fighting that I just don't ever want to deal with any form of conflict. So what can happen is you get into the relationship and it's like, okay, I just need to like get the relationship. Then you get the relationship, like, just need to get the engagement or whatever it is. And it's like, once you feel like you're on relatively solid footing, what some people can start to realize is, oh, I've kind of set this up where my needs are somewhat hidden in this relationship.
Yeah.
And I've kind of made out like I like everything they like and that I am totally okay with doing this stuff. And so for some people, it can feel really quite frightening at this particular point, because it's like, oh, if I start to reveal my true needs, you know, if I start to reveal who I really am, this relationship could be toast. Now, there are others, and of course it depends on how far down the road you are with this, but other people in that same situation, they try to assert themselves more, and it might be where they hit on conflict, because that's kind of a natural part of the unfolding of a relationship, is you are supposed to disagree sometimes and you are supposed to reveal more of yourselves as part of the intimacy of the relationship. But others also discover, oh, hold on a second, I'm relaxing into being myself, and my partner just breathes a sigh of relief. It's like, oh, you are actually real, like you are human, you're not this person who like never goes to the bathroom and whose face is always like perfect or who's like just always super agreeable. I've heard that plenty of times where a partner's just like, oh, I was so relieved when they finally dropped their guard, because it felt like, oh, I'm with this real person. Because what kind of relationship can you have if you won't go there in terms of conflict when you need to? It's not having conflict for conflict's sake. I am no fan of conflict, given how I grew up. I was telling a story the other day about how I was in, it must have been a couple of summers ago, so it was still like kind of like weird COVID-y lockdowns. We're in this ice cream place in central London, and there's a weird queuing system because, you know, COVID. We've been keeping an eye on the tables. And this woman, as soon as these people got up from the table, she just basically shot in front of my friend and sat down at the table. And next to my friend goes, we've been waiting here for this table. And no word of a lie. It was such an instinctive thing. If I could have thrown myself over the counter in the ice cream parlor, I would. Like, it was just, I felt myself
Like leaving your body.
Yes, leave my body, throw myself over the counter. Or it's like, you know, that that gif of Homer when he disappears into the bush, he reverses into it. Yes. That was me in that. It was like this total instant, like, oh my God, conflict. And it was a split second thing. But as soon as I noticed it, I was like laughing my head off.
Yeah.
But I, even in my own relationship, I've had to realize you have to go to town here. Like you have to be willing to go there. But it's tough.
I love that you say that, because in our relationship, he mentioned it, but like to this day, like I am a recovering people pleaser. Like I am still in our relationship, conflict avoidant. And like, I don't want to like deal with it. I just would rather like push it under the rug, like let it go. And he's like, no, like if we have a conversation, like in a really, you know,
thoughtful way,
intentional way, like we're going to be closer to each other. We're going to feel more connected. We're going to feel like we're on the same page more. And I can figure that out as we go through it and we get to the other side. But you're, like you said, like my first reaction, that's just so like innately in me, is to like, no, I don't want it. It's like almost like a fight or flight response. It feels like,
it totally is.
Yeah.
And it's all about our relationship with conflict. Like, I just did not have a healthy experience of conflict growing up at all.
Right.
And so it is no wonder that I am like that. But of course, you know, we're together, you know, a long time now, approaching 17 years as well. And what's interesting is our relationship of conflict has evolved over time. And like you, Chad, he would say, I know this is bothering you. So why don't you just say like it's bothering you? And it's interesting, because I could be very childish about conflicts initially, and I was embarrassed actually at how childish I could be. I remember my aunt once joking about how when I was a kid, and I had a really vague recollection of it, that when I was annoyed, and I'm talking apparently I was like 3 or something like this, but if I was annoyed, I would storm, I would say, and get my coatie. I had apparently this little red coat, and I would storm off out of the house. Now, I'd forgotten about this for a long time until my aunt brought it up, and I must have been in my 20s. But when they said it to me, I was like, oh my God, I could picture myself in all of my relationships, storm out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I've been doing apparently since I was like a toddler. Yep. And so what was interesting is the first 2 times that we had a disagreement in our relationship, I was like, I'm out of here. And he was like, what the frick are you doing? Like, who argues like this? He says, listen, I don't know what kind of relationships you've been in before, but that is like totally not appropriate. That is not argue. And I was like, oh. And I felt really like when he was saying that, like it, the aim of it wasn't to shame me, but actually what I realized is that I respected him too much to continue on with that. And I remember when I said to him, like, that is never going to happen again. And I even found the notes that I had written to him, about it, like a while back. And he said at the time, he was like, okay, you know, figuring, oh, you know, we're going to be here again. And obviously he was in it for the long haul, but, actually, I didn't do it again, because what would happen is I would get that sensation in that moment where I'm like, ugh. And sometimes it's like you want to get real like in your head. You're like, yeah, I'm going to cuss this person out, to tell them to. And then you go, why would you go there? Because you're overstepping a line. And so over the years, when you're in that relationship, just like you two are, you end up realizing that you have, I know it's an overused term, but that safe space to one, engage in conflict, but two, to evolve how you engage in conflict as well.
Yeah. I think the biggest fear I have, and I've seen it with a lot of people's relationships, is if you don't understand how to have a healthy relationship with conflict, especially within couples or marriages, etc., some get to the point where they just don't even bring things up anymore. Because it goes nowhere, and then you're just suppressed, and it's numb at that point. Mm. And so I kind of embrace it, honestly, because I think the whole process is really helpful. And that's what a partnership is. I think if you can have really differing opinions and have a fruitful discussion about it and come to a somewhat of an agreement, it's beautiful. And it's just something you need to do, I think, in a partnership when you're raising kids and you're making all these critical decisions all the time. And so, yeah, it's something
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. Conflict is a form of intimacy. So I'm not saying that always have conflict for conflict's sake, but you really don't know each other until you have allowed for the possibility of conflict. So it's not that you need to be in disagreement all the time, but you need to know that if you need to, that you can and you will.
Yeah.
And I hear too many people boasting, we never argue. And I'm like, that's not a badge of honor, because somebody's lying. Somebody's not telling the truth. Yeah. Somebody's probably getting their way at the expense of the other. And because conflict is a form of intimacy, if you have not, and this is where people pleasers fall afoul now, is that if you aren't expressing yourself, and so you're not, for instance, saying no when you need, want to, and should, and you are afraid to have boundaries in a relationship, and maybe you're kind of being subservient almost in it and acting like, oh, almost like a housekeeper. Some people kind of carry on like, I'm a housekeeper, I'm a babysitter, I'm a gardener, I'm the chef, or, you know, the core girl, or core guy, or whatever it is. It's like, no, that's not what your job is in the relationship. And if you have not allowed for conflict, then your relationship is not that intimate. Even if you've been together for 20 years, if you're not being yourself, then you have as much intimacy as somebody who was in the early stages of their relationship.
I think
so. What is that?
That's so powerful. And I think that, like, when you can recognize, like, what all the stuff you were saying before, like why you might be conflict avoidant because of where you came from, it allows you to have a little more compassion for yourself in order to move forward.
Hey fam, if you are listening here, then you may be someone who deals with chronic overwhelm, bloating, anxiety, and weight you can't lose, maybe hair loss or skin conditions. If one of those things rings true for you, the Wellness by Kelly Health and Hormones course is available to help you get to the root cause and solve the issue in a way that's sustainable and gives you your lifestyle with lasting results. No more diets or quick fixes, but real health and vitality for the long run. My course runs through everything from what labs to test for to what protocols to implement given what's off in your blood work. We cover a variety of hormonal imbalances and how to heal them, plus the mindset work that you'll have to do to change your habits. If you're ready for an environment where you can learn the tools and truly heal to feel your best, most aligned, light, confident version of you, then this course is for you. If you're feeling called to join the WBK Health and Hormones course, head to the link in the show notes to learn more, where you'll get my membership included with your purchase.
I want to talk about, because like we see, like we've talked so much about relationships, but in the women who I coach, and including myself, like people pleasing is such a big thing, not only to the spouse, but it's to the outside world. Like, how can I be super mom and do all the things for work and the kids and not let anyone down? And I want to know, from your perspective, do you see that as the primary reason that so many women are burnout?
Yeah, because we're trying to be like perfect women, wonder women. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to be perfect mom, perfect partner, perfect spouse, the perfect employee, the perfect, you know, PDA person, whatever it might be. So it's like we are subscribing to this idea of what we think it is to be a good something.
Right.
And the thing is that that can feel very noble and it can tap into our good qualities. But there's a big difference between being ourselves and performing at our idea of what we think a good something is. And so, for example, like I remember when, you know, my two girls, they're teenagers now, but I was like, you know, I was involved at school, but then I was like, well, hold on a second, Natalie, like you do want to be involved at school. That's part of the reason why you work for yourself, so that you've got that freedom, that flexibility to go there, but you don't have to also like volunteer for all
the things.
And also you don't need, almost as a knee-jerk reaction to your own childhood, try to overcompensate for that and try to be perfect or at least better than your own pounds. And so I think a big moment for me was one day my youngest was just being a nightmare with homework. And it was going on and on. And you know, just when you're just like, give me a break. And it was just dragging on and on. And of course, just kids, homework. And eventually I was like, oh, for goodness sake. And I was like, I was just like frustrated. And then I promptly burst into tears. And my daughter was looking at me like, what? And I realized that the reason why I burst into tears is because I'm like, oh my God, I'm turning into my mom. And I really had to look at myself because, okay, not my greatest moments, right? Yeah. However, one, it doesn't make me my mom because we sometimes experience physical punishment when we got something wrong with homework or when we weren't doing stuff on time. When you think of the things that so many of us went through when we were kids and what our parents would say or do or teachers or whatever, just a totally different time. But I also recognize I also don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater as if my experience of being mothered is so terrible that I have to totally overcompensate for that and be this pristine mother, because then I was feeling like tired and resentful because I'm sort of undoing the housework. Like I'm trying to keep a perfect house and I'm trying to be like a perfect in work and perfect. It's too much. And I think a lot of women struggle with it. One, because we have less margin to say no, right?
Yeah.
So men and women, all of us humans, we are all to some degree socialized into people pleasing, right?
Totally.
But men receive messages about what it is to please others. And it can be, you know, you must be hyper masculine, you know, don't show emotions, make sure you are the man of the house, you are boss, you are in charge, you know, all this type of stuff. Don't be a sissy. What are you crying for? What are you doing? That's very effeminate, isn't it? So be a good little boy in whatever version that is. But because we are all in this patriarchal system, the messages that men receive, even though it's still problematic and it is still basically tapping into people pleasing, it ends up still facilitating them having more power, having more agency. Whereas the messages that women and girls receive is like, be sweet, be meek, be mild, don't be rude, don't talk out of turn, cross your legs, don't be a slut, don't be this, don't be that. And of course, depending on where you are in the world, you may have way less margin than you or I do, for instance, Kelly. So we end up receiving messages that limit our agency because that's the systems that we've grown up in. And it can feel scary as a girl or a woman to say no in certain situations, because it can literally feel life or death. You know, something I've said recently, you know, with Prince Harry's autobiography coming out and everybody's like, oh my God. But actually it just tells us about our societal discomfort with people saying no and drawing a line. But one of the things I've noticed is that actually it also highlights about who is allowed to say no. And so a man can say no, for instance, at work, because then it's seen as, oh, that's a power move. But if a woman says no in the same context, it's like difficult.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if we think about the whole thing of romantic relationships, and we speak specifically about heteronormative relationships, the guy gets to be like, I like you. I choose you to be in a relationship, or I choose you to give a wedding ring to. But if that same woman turns around who's involved and says, actually, I'm not interested in you. Oh my gosh. Like for some men, it's like the end of the world.
Yeah.
It's like, how dare you say no to me? So it's
so
this
true.
Whole thing is who gets to say no. And I think because of these messages that we've received about what we are and aren't allowed to do, we are all struggling with our no. But I think a lot of women are burning out. You know, I'm 45. I grew up in a women can have it all. And all of a sudden it was okay for me to go to university and have a job, but also I needed to be in a relationship too. I realized, I don't know, within a year of being in at work, if this is what happened at all, it's like,
yeah, I don't want it.
It was exhausting.
It's so true. And I think that's like, you even go to like it's from your parents, from the movies, from like, and then you even go to like what you were saying, like you'll go to like a cocktail party and people are like, so you guys are married. And then the next question is like, when are you going to have a kid? And then when are you going to have another kid? And it's like, there's so much pressure all the time. And I think that that's why it like the pressure to be perfect. And then it's like the pressure to subscribe to those norms that you're talking about, or like the expectations that people have. And so one of the things you said is like, this idea of being perfect and like us trying to live up to that versus our idea of like what we really want for ourselves. How do you start to, and I know people read the book, I'm sure they're going to get tons of answers to that, but how do you start to differentiate that so that you can say no to the things that actually you want to say no to, or say yes to the things that are really truly aligned with you versus trying to project that perfection out to the world?
Authentically yourself. Yeah, exactly. Really the question.
Yeah. So I think that there's a few things that you can really sort of notice that let you know where you are people pleasing, and where, even if it contains an element of you, that you're doing what can appear to be good things, but for the wrong reasons, because it's the intention behind it that that makes it people pleasing. Like, lots of people want to, I don't know, help out people, stay behind at work, whatever it might be, but they don't do it because they're afraid that if they don't do it, something terrible is going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it because they are trying to compensate for underlying feelings of low self-worth. They're not doing it because they're like, well, if I do this, then maybe I'm going to get this back in return. And so things to look out for is, it's like, I should, I must, I can't. Where is that coming from? Because we often have these hard and fast rules about how we're supposed to be going about doing things. And when we notice that we're thinking and acting and talking and feeling in that way, that we can go, is that actually
true?
And not just true, is this actually true for me? I think also it's important to notice where you're experiencing what I call the people pleaser feelings, which include like guilt, anxiety, resentment, frustration, overwhelm, feeling overloaded, low, helplessness, powerlessness. Those types of feelings are an indicator that even if you thought it was a good thing, you have said yes to something for the wrong reasons. And when I say you've said yes, you may have directly, very consciously said yes, or you may have gone along with something, or you may just remain silent and that was taken as you saying yes. So notice where you are having those feelings, or notice where you know, like sometimes people ask you for something or to do something, and outwardly you go, yeah, sure, no problem. Inwardly, I can't believe that, beep, beep, beep in your head. You know, you're saying all of this stuff, or you're already mentally working out, how am I going to get out of this?
Yes.
You've outwardly gone, sure, I'll be there. Inwardly, you're going, oh my God, I totally have to get out of this. So you're trying to mentally shuffle your calendar, trying to work out what your perfect excuse will be. Notice when you're doing that. Notice as well when you are asked, for instance, to do something, and in your head you're going, oh, but if I don't do this, people are going to judge me. People are going to think whatever. Because these are all signs that you actually don't want to do the thing, or that you need to find a better reason to do the thing. And I think that when you start to notice these can give you clues about where your people pleasing is showing up in your life. You know, that's why I encourage people to get to know their pleaser. But also, I'll give an example, and I know there'll be, you know, many women listening who can identify with this. You may, for instance, have this notion of being a good mother or a good employee or a good partner or whatever it might be. But there may be a difference between that and what your actual priorities and values are. So for instance, you might be like, I'm trying to be a good employee, but you also really value your personal time. Maybe you want to spend time with your children or with your partner, and you don't want to be working all hours. And yet it's your day off and you're working, and you've got other things that you want to be doing. Maybe you want to be relaxing, but actually you are hunched over your laptop or huddled up with your grocery shopping in the car, taking another call, trying to sort out something. And you are taking those calls and doing those things because it's like, oh, well, that's what a good employee does. But that is putting you at odds with who you say you are and what your priorities are. And also because if you're exhausted and you have no time to yourself, is that actually how you want to live your life? Like, do you want to be burnout? Do you want to be feeling like the slightest thing could tip you over the edge? Right. And so when you notice those differences, and in the book, I talk about this as one of the steps, is notice the difference between desire, you know, make it a desire or say no. So notice the difference between desire and obligation. Mm-hmm. What do you feel like you have to do? What do you feel like you're obliged to do? And what do you actually want to do? Because if you don't actually want to do it, then you definitely should be saying no, or you need to be having an honest conversation. And the funny thing is that for a lot of people, when they have that choice, when you say to them, okay, you feel like it's an obligation, okay, talk to the person about it. I feel like I have to do this particular thing. Oh, no, I don't want to talk about it. Then say no.
I think that's really helpful.
Maybe just diving into the book a little bit, because I think it's fascinating. Tell us kind of perhaps quickly about these five different types of people pleasers, so people can maybe
self-identify
which right. one they may be.
Yeah.
I mean, probably everyone is one of them to an extent, I would think.
Mm. So the five styles of people pleasing are gooding, efforting, avoiding, saving, and suffering. So the names in and of themselves start to give hints about what you tend to do. So you're trying to be good or look good. Mm-hmm. You're very much about effort, you know, being the best, trying the hardest, being perfect, giving 100%. Yeah. And then it might be that your style is avoiding, as in you're avoiding anything that you think will create even the slightest discomfort for others. So it's like, oh, well, I'll just never bring that thing up. And then I'll make sure I keep everything hunky-dory. You know, if your life is totally about avoiding conflict, you're in the avoiding.
Yeah.
And then saving as, you know, the helpers, fixers, saviors of this world, who their way of making themselves feel good is through what they do for others. So they have an element maybe of the gooding and the efforting, but it's all about help, fixing, saving. And then suffering, you know, some people feel like the more you suffer, the better it makes you as a person. And so they think, well, I bleed for you. I busted up my boundaries for you. Now will you love me? Now will you do what I want? And what these five styles are really about as well is recognizing what drives you, so that you can recognize where your people pleasing shows up. Because as the name suggests, you're driven by being good, or you're driven by effort, or you're driven by avoiding or wanting to help, or being in pain. And this can help you to recognize where that people pleasing is showing up, because awareness is the key. This is what I've heard from so many people about this, is that they thought being a people pleaser was like being a doormat, or that it was a badge of honor. And that when they are aware of these styles of people pleasing, or just their intentions, like noticing their weird whys, and where they're sometimes telling people what they think they want to hear, they're like, oh, that's the people pleasing. And then they can consciously choose to do something else instead.
Yeah. So that's, I'm guessing, I was going to ask you right after that, like all of those styles, because I think that people do, I mean, coming from somebody who as their job gives people advice, people do really mm-hmm. well with like a tangible small step, right? And I know you mm-hmm. have a ton of those in the book. Everybody go out and get Natalie's book, because I think that, like I said, I think it could serve everybody. But if you could give everybody, like the listeners, one small step that they could take, is it like to try to say no to one thing? Is it what's the small step to move away from what they don't want to feel anymore?
So I think the small step is actually the noticing. Mm-hmm. So you can't know what your people pleasing is or what to say no to if you don't actually notice how you're spending your yes, no's, and maybes in the first place. So when you just, it's like that little bit of extra few seconds to notice, oh, I feel a bit funny around that particular person. Or, oh my gosh, when I see their name come up on my phone, I'm like dreading, you know, or That's why I say that first step is get to know your pleaser. But it is that first step to saying no, because otherwise, look, a lot of people, they think, oh, I'll just read the book, leap out of bed tomorrow morning and just fire off all of these no's. And then life will just be fantastic and sunshine and My Little Ponies. And we all know that that's not the way that it's going to be. So instead, it's that noticing and how our lives can change so much by noticing the content of our lives. So notice, where are those funny feelings showing up? Yeah. That's a great first step, because then you're going to get clues to where you can say no and take better care of yourself.
I love it.
Would you say the same is true? I'm guessing it is around conflict. I'll give you an example. I think we're both like 0 to 100 type people. So like we'll go from 0 to 100 real fast. I'll tend to go on offense and she'll tend to go on defense, you know, more defensive in terms of like your argumentative style, I would say. And I feel like if you just took a couple moments and understood how quickly that just went from here to here, you might be a little bit more thoughtful and you know, just diligent about how you not avoid the conflict, but move through it and come to a conclusion.
Oh yeah. It's that power of the pause. Like, it's funny. We know, if we're honest with ourselves, we know actually when we are close to a conflict situation, because there's certain sensations that we get in our body. Mm-hmm. You know
when you're being unreasonable too, because you're like, yeah, I can't believe
you
said
do.
That.
Like, and you're in a relationship long enough, you know this person, like myself, my husband. It's not that we argue all the time, but it's funny. On those occasions when we do argue, I just know it's on the way. Like he would say, he feels like I start to get like a bone, you know, between my teeth.
You want to do it.
He's like, you just won't drop it, because I'll be like, well, no, let's just talk. And he'll be like, hold on a sec. He's now realizing, oh, we're about to get into an argument, because he's set the stage and he's poked.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, okay, fine, we'll do this. And then he's like, oh, I've actually poked. And he's like, oh, no, I don't want to do it. And I'm like, no, actually, I need you. And then he gets really annoyed that I still want to go at that. But what's interesting is you do notice, what are your hot button topics? Family is that one. It tends to be, you know, like big family events, you know, or the mothers. Those are hot button subjects for us. You know, when you're overtired as well, and you kind of get that perfect stomach conditions. But when you know when you're being reasonable, you know that kind of, it's different to the normal conversations that you have, because you start to say or do certain things. And I think that if we're aware of these things, it doesn't mean that we won't argue. But, you know, like sometimes in my head, I'm going, Natalie, just leave it be. And sometimes I do. And sometimes I'm like, he just says one more thing and I'm like, what?
So true. Going back to a little bit earlier, kind of talking about the idea of like saying no and people pleasing and boundaries, can we, you know, we're all like, not all, but I'm not, that's generalizing, but most of us are on that edge of the spectrum that it's like, we got to say no to some more stuff so we can not be burnt out, so that we can feel like we have more intimate relationships, so that we can feel like we're being our authentic selves. But can we ever get to the opposite end of the spectrum where it's like, we're not really doing anything for other people? And like, we're too involved, like self-involved, or do you feel like that's really not in this world, like a capacity?
No, I would say it is.
I think that, I mean, it is the great fear that a lot of people have, which actually tells us a lot about what we associate with no. That a lot of people are like, oh my God, so is this going to tell me like to a really selfish person? Is this going to tell me like into an ass clan, something like that, you know? And you're like, I think that when we go the total opposite way, we think that that's about boundaries, but that's actually about anger and defense and self-protection. Cause it's like, I don't trust anyone. So I'm just going to kind of close myself off and just be like, right, it's all about me. And that's not the same as being boundaried. And sometimes that's a space that people have to go through. Like before I kind of entered into this phase of my journey, I went through, I guess I must have been realizing that I was frustrated with certain things. And so all of a sudden I was like,
and it's almost like self-protection almost, because you've been through so much of people maybe like walking all over you, or like you not voicing your opinion. And then it's like, okay, now I need to like overstep, and then we get back into a place of balance.
Exactly. I think what happens sometimes is that people feel like, oh my God, I've just realized I have not been saying no, I've not been having boundaries. I need to make up for last time. And so what ends up happening is they end up sometimes it's for the people that they've had that struggle with, but sometimes they just focus it on random people and are like, right, well, you're going to get it because you're next in line. And I've now decided that I'm going to say no. And to be fair, I think that this can be part of the process. Like I say to people, if you're waiting to say no perfectly and to kind of create your boundaries perfectly, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Because actually it is trial and error. Sometimes you're going to say the wrong thing. You know, I say to people, if your sentence has the word boundaries in it, you're probably not being that boundaries. So if you're like, my boundaries are da, 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 you're probably not being that boundaries. Because the thing that I try to get across to people is we are our boundaries. So our boundaries are as much about what we say yes to as they are about no. We're the living embodiment of our boundaries. Mm-hmm. If I say to you, what's your name? And you're like, Kelly and Chad. And I turn around and go, oh, hey, Kel and C. But you never told me I could call you Kel and C. Now, maybe you won't mind, but at the end of the day, if I call you something completely different to that, and I'm like, I'm going to call you Cassandra and I'm going to call you Charlie. That's me overstepping a boundary there. That's a simple way of showing boundaries. So I do think that you're right, there are some people who I think are like, oh, but I also think actually in the world that we live in, where far too many of us are far too compliant, it can feel uncomfortable to us to be around people who are like, no, I'm not doing that. Because it's like, well, why won't you just be a bit more compliant and accommodating?
Yeah.
And we feel uncomfortable with that because it makes us go, but I'm always saying yes to stuff and being accommodating. So I think that I think for most people, it's not really a concern unless you go into the real anger zone.
Okay. That's super.
And you'll come out the other side of that.
Yeah. So I don't want to, you know, exclude Chad from this conversation, and I want you to chime in and like tell us what you think. But one of the things that you brought up, Natalie, was that this idea of like women, obviously, we tend to have that projection onto us from a very young age of like, be sweet, don't say, you know, don't be rude, be polite, that all that kind of stuff. And then as we grow into some of us mothers, some of us working women, for some reason for us, it becomes harder to put ourselves first. Mm-hmm. And we tend to value what everybody else needs before we start to value our own needs. Mm. So can you tell us, do you see that as the case, like you said, most of the time? And if so, how do women start to own their own value a little bit more so that they can start to put themselves first with everything that has to be on their to-do list? Do you feel that way? Or do you feel, I want to know, like, I want to hear from you too.
Me and my own.
Like, do you feel like women are, I don't want to put us in a box, but like we tend to feel like we have to take care of everybody else. And like, I feel like you kind of are like there, when there's something you want to do, you kind of just chill and do it.
I don't know if I'm
qualified. You sound like my husband.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm qualified, so I'll be sensitive here. But I think that our society greatly lauds and approves of supermoms and supermom mentality.
Yeah.
It's the idea that you're doing everything and that you're taking care of all of it. And that's viewed as like the perfect mom, and now there's a lot of constructs around like being the CEO and the mom at the same time and doing, you know, three other things. And so I think it's mostly societal. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I had to notice myself was like where I was even judging other women for like certain things.
And like validation.
That what,
like, oh, she does that. Like, yeah, it's possible, but it's like, it's Instagram. It's not real.
That, and also where I would be like, I use this example a lot, but like, our younger one wasn't sleeping through the night for a really long time. He was like 7 or 8 months. And I was judging other women who had a night nurse. I was like, I'll never do that. They're like, you know, they're lazy. They're, you know, they don't want to be with their kids. And like, when I took a step back and I was like, wait a second, like if I did this one night a week or something like that for myself, like it would let me show up better for the kids. I'd be less reactive. I would be better at work because I wouldn't be so exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
So I had to look at some judgments that I had too, but, and that helped me kind of start to value myself and do something that would be caring for myself. But how can women start to value themselves rather than always putting everybody else before themselves?
So I think that's what we often feel uncomfortable admitting, is that we can be very entrenched in these ideas about what it is to be, you know, a Wonder Woman, super mom, super CEO, whatever. Mm-hmm. But we can be very uncomfortable in recognizing that there is resentment there. Because that resentment is often accompanied by exhaustion and tension and overwhelm and guilt and the other people pleaser feelings. And so it's one thing if we can hand on heart say, I am like so super happy with my life. And I'm so super happy with the way that I am being and all of these things I'm taking on. Obviously, the overwhelming majority of people who are trying to do it all, be it all, have it all, are not. And if you can recognize these feelings, that can act as a signpost to help you be a bit more honest about all of the things that you feel that you have to do. I would encourage anybody who's like trying to do all this stuff and say, well, I have to do this, or I can't believe that they do that. Why? Get out a piece of paper. What are all the things that I feel that I have to do? Well, I got to keep a perfect home, and I got to make sure that, you know, the bathroom's done X amount of times a week, and I'm not going to have a cleaner for this because, well, I should be doing it myself. I should be able to juggle it all, whatever all of those is. And then be like, look through that list, because that's a lot to be carrying around on you. How much of that, and this goes back to what we said earlier, how much of that is actually true? So something that I had this eye-opening moment a couple of summers ago where our youngest had, because of the pandemic, had experienced anxiety and OCD. And so we had got her extra support. And part of that was that we did these 6 sessions of family therapy, which was for them to help us understand what she was going through, but also to help her understand what the entire family had gone through, you know, as all of this was going on. So part of that was, you know, she was asking, oh, tell each of you, tell me about the other and that type of stuff. And one, there was this moment in it where I realized that we had succeeded in giving our children the normal happy childhood that we had sought out for our children. But I also had this realization that, one, I was the one with the jacked up childhood, and also that it was only me that cares about the house being like super tidy, and not even super tidy, but like it's only me losing my mind over that. Something was said, and I suddenly realized, it's like, Natalie, you are the one imposing your standards on everybody else, and then losing your mind over it because either they don't care as much about it, or you've exhausted from trying to keep up with all of these things. And I remember sitting there, and she was saying whatever, and they were laughing about something. And I was like, Natalie, it's only you that cares about this. And when I was reflecting on that, like, my mom was obsessive about the house growing up. So I think that somewhere along the way, I picked up some of those things. And I was like, oh, well, I've been doing it. And I've had to release myself from some of these standards because I value being in my bed super early, or being relaxed, or not losing it with everybody. You're banging the vacuum cleaner around the place of, oh, why can't you put I actually value like that sort of connectivity. Yes, I still like things to be relatively tiny, but I don't want it to control. I don't want to use that to control myself or to control others. Mm. And so it was making these realizations like, oh, I'm trying to please some unrealistic standard of motherhood. And when you can have these moments of realization and go, why am I doing this? Like, ask yourself, why am I doing this? Mm. Like, why am I exhausting myself for work or motherhood? Do your kids want you to be exhausted? Do you even want to be exhausted? What can you let go of in all of this?
Yeah.
I think that that's the whole thing is when you realize that you're exhausted or you're pissed off or whatever it might be, first thing you need to look at, what do I need to say no to? Yeah. As soon as you can let go of some things, you will start to relinquish yourself from these unrealistic expectations. And what you discover, if you give yourself more than a hot minute, the sky doesn't fall down when you do a bit less. It really doesn't.
I think the most powerful, like, important thing that you said there is that there's going to be, I think that what people don't really recognize is, and it's sitting there right in front of you, but I think that what a lot of us don't really recognize is that there's going to have to be something that you're willing to give up or something that you're going to have to be willing to let go of or relinquish control on if you want to have the feeling that you want to have, whether it's peace or connection or like more of whatever the thing is, there has to mm-hmm. be something that's going to take it. So if it's the tidiness of the house, like, okay, like be okay with that. It's going to be a little uncomfortable at first, but the more that you get the other thing that you want, like that connection with your kids or not feeling exhausted when you wake up the next day, it's like, damn, that's actually really worth it.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned about when your son wasn't sleeping that well.
Yeah.
And when our eldest was about, I don't know, probably 4.5, 5 months old, went through that phase, you know, when they're kind of getting ready to start like weaning. And so they kind of, their mm-hmm. sleeping gets really erratic and the breastfeeding wasn't enough. And I just went through this week or two where I felt like this really bad mom for considering introducing formula into it. Now, if somebody had said that I would be like that 6 months before, I'd have been like, pfft. But you know what had happened? I'd been in this mom and baby group where it was like, how long have you been breastfeeding for? How much does your baby weigh? Is your baby sleeping? Blah, 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 blah. And then I heard myself, like, I was crying one day about this. My husband was looking at me like,
what?
Are you on crack? Like, why? Why would you be? And, but I was holding myself like, oh my gosh. How much of a failure am I that I'm considering introducing formula at this point and I'm not going to exclusively breastfeed like for however long? And I heard myself and I was like, this is not you. And the moment that I acknowledged that, boom.
It was easy.
Easy.
That's a big one. That one specifically is how long have you breastfed, and it's deemed as like
so
selfish if you can't, you know, breastfeed for a certain amount of time. And then there's like these heroic figures, so they claim often that they've done it for like 2-3 years, etc. It's like when an Uber driver always tells you about his side business because he's somewhat ashamed to be an Uber driver.
You know what I mean? Oh my gosh, that is spot on. Is totally spot on.
So Natalie, thank you so much. This conversation is going to be so helpful. Everybody go out and get Natalie's book, The Joy of Saying No, and subscribe to her podcast, The Baggage Reclaim, and her sessions and her blog, Baggage Reclaim. So thank you. Where can everyone find you?
And the book.
So social media wise, I'm on Vidi's Instagram. I'm at Natlue, NATLUE on there. The book is available like at all the kind of the places, you know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Apple Books, kind of forgetting some bookshop.org, and of course in independent booksellers as well. And yeah, please, if you can, I'd love it if you go out and buy the book.
Yes.
Absolutely. This
was such a great conversation, and there's so many more like beautiful nuggets in the book of taking back your own power and being your authentic self and being able to say no to the things that you don't want to do. So thank you, Natalie. I am so grateful for your time. We are.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to hang out with you both.
Thank you so much.
We really hope that you enjoyed that episode. You can follow me on Instagram at Wellness by Kelly. And if you're new around here, you can sign up for the WBK 7-day free trial where you can get access to all of my low impact workouts, blood sugar balancing, plant-based recipes, and guided meditations, all available on wellnessbykelly.com and on the WBK app.
Hey, thanks for listening.
Please make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also connect with us on social media at Wellness by Kelly. Drop us a DM for who you want to hear from.